Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, confronting climate change. The president announces ambitious targets for reducing carbon emissions as part of the fight against the global crisis. Then, a troubling surge. India records the highest one-day number of new COVID infections of any nation since the pandemic began, overwhelming the country's already stressed healthcare system. Plus, the plastic problem. Single-use items like masks, gloves, and takeout containers pile up in landfills and wreak havoc on the environment.
It's not just about the fact that masks are not biodegradable or recyclable. It's about the fact that they are a hazard for our wildlife.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Leaders of the United States and other countries have set ambitious new goals today to slow the planet from heating up. They left open exactly how they would accomplish those goals as they met in a virtual long-distance gathering. William Brangham has our report.
Good morning.
With dozens of world leaders in attendance virtually, President Biden said it was urgent for the world to address climate change.
This is a moral imperative, an economic imperative. A moment of peril, but also a moment of extraordinary possibilities.
The president pledged to cut America's greenhouse gas emissions in half from 2005 levels by 2030, and he urged other nations to follow suit.
All of us, and particularly those of us who represent the world's largest economies, we have to step up.
And some of the world's largest carbon emitters seem to heed the call. China's President Xi Jinping cited an earlier pledge to phase out the use of coal.
China will strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality before 2060.
The Prime Minister of the Republic of India.
And India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, repeated a promise to boost renewable energy projects by 2030.
We in India are doing our part.
But commitments to new benchmarks came from elsewhere. Japan said it would cut emissions by 46% below 2013 levels by the end of the decade. And Canada pledged to slash at least 40% of its 2005 emission levels in the same time frame. Today's summit was timed to coincide with Earth Day and also coincided with calls from leading climate activist Greta Thunberg at a hearing on Capitol Hill.
How long do you honestly believe that people in power like you will get away with it? How long do you think you can continue to ignore the climate crisis, the global aspect of equity and historic emissions, without being held accountable?
We have to remember.
The global meeting continues tomorrow, leading up to a larger UN climate conference slated for November in Scotland. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
In the day's other news, California's two state university systems, the nation's largest, joined a wave of colleges mandating COVID-19 vaccinations for students this fall. Meanwhile, India reported a global record of nearly 315,000 infections in 24 hours, with another 2,100 deaths. We'll have details on India after the news summary. The U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan COVID-19 hate crimes bill today, responding to attacks on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. It includes funding to increase data collection and reporting. Hawaii's Democratic Senator Mazie Hirono co-sponsored the measure.
As important as the content and substance of the bill is the message of this bill that we in the Senate are going to stand with our AAPI community and indeed any community that is discriminated against on the basis of race or any of the categories that you and I can think of.
The U.S. House of Representatives may act on a similar bill in coming weeks. Today, the U.S. House voted again to make Washington, D.C. the nation's 51st state. Democrats pushed it through on party lines with no Republican support. Prospects for passage in the evenly divided Senate are low. Russia has announced that its troops are withdrawing from the border with Ukraine, but leaving their heavy weapons in place. Thousands of Russian troops had taken part in maneuvers in Crimea and western Russia. The defense minister said today they have achieved their goals. Ukraine's president welcomed the move. Israel and Syria traded allegations today after trading fire overnight. The Israelis said that they launched airstrikes when a Syrian anti-aircraft missile mistakenly flew deep into Israel. It exploded near Dimona, the desert town where Israel's nuclear reactor is located. Syria said the Israeli air raid came first. Indonesia is searching desperately for a submarine with 53 crewmen aboard. It disappeared Wednesday. The hunt centered off of Bali today, where the sub sank in deep water. Extreme pressure may have crushed it. If not, the crew runs out of oxygen by Saturday. Back in this country, Senate Republicans offered their own infrastructure plan. It would cost nearly $570 billion over 5 years. President Biden wants $2.3 trillion over 8 years. Both sides talk today of compromise and their own plans.
Well, it's time to say we want to do things that are really in the best interest of the American people, what the American people are asking for. And that's why we're here today with this proposal that was sent to the White House a little earlier today.
The president has said from the beginning that he would welcome any good faith effort to find common ground, because the only unacceptable step would be inaction.
The White House also said the president would consider smaller steps and not one mega bill. The governor of Kansas vetoed a bill today aimed at barring transgender students from girls' sports teams in public schools. Democrat Laura Kelly called the legislation regressive. Overnight, North Dakota's Republican Governor Doug Burgum vetoed a similar measure, but faced a possible override. Several states have already enacted such bans. Unemployment claims in the U.S. fell to 547,000 last week. That is the lowest since the pandemic began. But Wall Street retreated today on reports of possible capital gains tax hikes on the wealthy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 321 points to close below 33,816. The Nasdaq fell 131 points. The S&P 500 slipped 38. Still to come on the NewsHour, the president announces ambitious targets for confronting climate change. Single-use plastic items pile up in landfills and wreak havoc on the environment. The U.S. continues to grapple with police shootings despite the Chauvin conviction, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Now to the COVID-19 disaster in India. More than a year into the pandemic, the caseloads and deaths in the South Asian nation are skyrocketing. As Amna Nawaz reports, while vaccines are being rolled out, stopping the spread is proving a monumental task.
A grim reminder in India that the global pandemic is far from over, as the second most populous country in the world recorded the most new COVID cases in a single day, nearly 315,000, more than any other country at any point in the pandemic. India's infection total of 15.9 million is now second only to the United States.
People are really scared. They are terrified. Most people have isolated themselves in a self-imposed lockdown. They are not stepping out unnecessarily, and the roads are all empty.
Early in the pandemic, in March of 2020, Prime Minister Narendra Modi swiftly imposed a nationwide 21-day lockdown, the largest in the world. But in recent months, even as cases rose, Modi hosted huge political rallies, flouted social distancing, and allowed mass gatherings, including thousands of Hindu pilgrims at a time along the Ganges River for the Kumbh Mela festival. On Tuesday, Modi addressed the virus surge.
Till a few weeks ago, the situation was in control, and then this second wave of coronavirus has come like a storm. Friends, in the current situation, we have to save the country from another lockdown. I would also like to request states to only use lockdown as a last resort.
Meanwhile, India's hospitals are overrun, oxygen supplies are depleted, and crematoriums are overwhelmed. leaving some, like Vinay Srivastava, begging for help online. The 65-year-old journalist tweeted as his oxygen levels plummeted, quote, "My oxygen is 31. When some will help me," he wrote April 17th. No hospital could take him, and he died soon after. On Wednesday, an oxygen leak in western India led to 24 deaths, including this woman's mother.
"My mother died. She could not get oxygen, and she died in agony. She has been here since the past 5 days. She had recovered. There was no oxygen. She died in agony. She had trouble breathing. She died. Everyone there died."
The New Delhi High Court has ordered the government to divert oxygen from industrial use to hospitals to try and save lives as the number of coronavirus cases continues to grow.
Dr. Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan is an economist, epidemiologist, and senior research scholar with Princeton University. He joins me now from New Delhi, India. Doctor, welcome to the NewsHour, and thanks for joining us. You are in New Delhi. Can you just describe what it is you're seeing there?
It's probably the worst humanitarian crisis that I've ever witnessed. There are people without hospital beds. There's no oxygen. I'm hearing of people who are dying because the oxygen ran out in their hospitals. It's indescribable. And I hope to never witness anything like what we're going through right now in Delhi.
As an epidemiologist, when you see that spike, you see that curve going like this, do you worry what happens if that goes unchecked?
Well, as an epidemiologist, I know that the place that that curve goes is basically determined entirely by human behavior and people's attitudes. So it's there because mass gatherings were allowed, because the messaging was poor in terms of how serious the virus was and is. And the system is already overrun right now, and it's hard to imagine what it's going to look like when we have another million cases over the next 3 or 4 days and another million after the next 3 or 4 days after that.
You mentioned the mass gatherings, the reopenings. We all remember when Prime Minister Modi locked down the entire country. What led to the decision to reopen to this degree?
The country was locked down when the cases were only 500, simply because there was an understanding that it could simply not deal with the kind of upswing we're seeing right now a year ago when the system was unprepared. After September, the cases started coming down. And like with many other countries, people both in government and outside assumed that the worst was over and that India had, crossed into some sense of herd immunity and the cases were not going to come back. Now, that was obviously not true. In a country the size of India, even if you have 300 million infections in the first round, that still leaves over 1 billion people who have not yet been infected. And that's sufficient to have a second, maybe even a third and a fourth wave. And that's what we're seeing now.
Many of the reports we're seeing are coming from urban centers and from city locations. What about the non-urban areas? What about rural areas where we know the majority of India's population lives?
70% of India lives in rural areas, and the virus has definitely spread there. In fact, even on this round, the predominantly affected populations are the urban well-off who escaped the virus in the first round. The lockdown protected the well-off even as it ravaged the poor in urban areas. This time around, it's definitely in rural India as well, where the infrastructure is much weaker.
What about vaccines, doctor? We know India is a vaccine producer. Where is India in its vaccination process?
India got off to a great start with two vaccines, one developed by Oxford and licensed to India by AstraZeneca. The other one was a truly indigenous Indian vaccine. India was exporting a lot of vaccines, but the production was not accounted for properly in the sense that there's a shortage of vaccines now. There's hardly enough even to meet the domestic demand, let alone export vaccine to other countries.
We know some states have implemented lockdowns. Do you expect there to be more leaders taking that step? Do you think another national lockdown is necessary to slow the spread now?
I think a national lockdown is unlikely, both because it's probably not necessary. The virus is not bad everywhere. It's probably not sustainable given the condition of India's economy. But state-level lockdowns, like in New Delhi, Maharashtra, these will likely continue. And in some sense, that's the only tool that is left to governments to be able to signal the seriousness of the virus.
If that messaging is not made clear, what do you worry will happen?
If that messaging is not made clear even now, after all the scenes that we all hear, every family has been affected by COVID at this point in time that I'm aware of. But if people don't take that seriously, both policymakers and ordinary folks, we could see this being a lot more painful over the next few weeks than it already is.
That is Dr. Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan joining us from New Delhi, India tonight. Thank you so much for your time, Doctor. We wish you well.
Thanks for having me.
Now, let's turn to the ambitions of today's climate summit and the very real challenges to President Biden's plans. Michael Mann is a climate scientist and professor of atmospheric sciences at Penn State University. He's the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Our continuing coverage of these issues this week is part of the international journalism collaborative called Covering Climate Now. Michael Mann, welcome to the NewsHour. Let me just start by asking, how ambitious is President Biden's plan that he's laid out compared to what any country's done before now?
Yeah, thanks, Judy. It's good to be with you. And it is a bold plan. Make no mistake about it. I think that Joe Biden is, surprising some of the skeptics who didn't think that he would lead on the issue of climate change, who were skeptical that he would show the sort of bold leadership that's necessary. But here we have the United States really laying down the gauntlet for other countries, a commitment to lower carbon emissions by a factor of two within the next 10 years. That is doable, and it is essential if we are to avert catastrophic warming of the planet, more than 3 degree Fahrenheit warming of the planet, where we will start to see some of the worst impacts of climate change. That's what we've got to do globally. And here the United States is setting an example for other countries to follow.
Well, let me read for you what the New York Times is reporting would be required by the end of the decade in order to meet the president's goal of cutting emissions in half. More than half of all new cars and SUVs would need to be powered by electricity, not gasoline. Nearly all coal-fired power plants would need to be shut down. Forests would need to expand, and the number of wind turbines and solar panels would quadruple. Is that realistic?
Yeah, well, nothing that's worth doing is easy. It's certainly a monumental task, but there is quite a bit of research now. Teams from Stanford and the University of California, for example, that have demonstrated that we can get there with existing technology. We don't need a miracle, Bill Gates, who's said that in the past. We have the technology necessary to solve this problem. What we need is the political willpower, and we need the policies. And we've got leadership from the president in terms of executive actions that address the climate crisis. We're also going to need a legislative component. We're going to need climate legislation to make its way through Congress if we are going to meet those commitments.
What are going to be the easier pieces of this, and what are the harder pieces?
So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, as it were. There are lots of things that we can do, for example, that save us money and they decrease our carbon emissions. They're win-win. Clean energy jobs, creating a resilient smart grid that can be powered with renewable energy. These are all things that will improve our infrastructure, that will provide jobs. But again, it's not going to be easy. If we are to wean ourselves from coal and natural gas and oil, essentially within a decade, we are going to need policies that incentivize that shift. We need to put a price on carbon. We need to provide massive subsidies for renewable energy. We need to block the development of additional fossil fuel infrastructure. These are all things that the Biden plan supports. But again, we need to codify that in terms of legislation if we're going to accomplish that.
Michael Mann, we know this is a global crisis, hence the 40 world leaders participating in today's summit. Tell us, how important is it what other major contributors of emissions like China, like India, how important is it what they do, how much they contribute to dealing with this?
Yeah, well, it's essential. We are the world's largest cumulative emitter of carbon pollution. For nearly two centuries, we've been producing carbon pollution. Right now, China is the largest current emitter of carbon pollution. And so clearly we need the world's two largest emitters, the United States and China, to come together to, in fact, create an atmosphere that leads other countries to make meaningful commitments. That's what happened under the Obama administration. We had a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and China that really had teeth in it, and it laid the groundwork for a very successful Paris Treaty. Now, what happened subsequently, obviously, Donald Trump came in, he pulled out of the Paris Agreement, that took the pressure off of China, and after having been decommissioning coal-fired power plants, they started building them again. So I think there's reason to be optimistic that now with the U.S. once again demonstrating leadership, reaching a bilateral agreement again just last week with China, that creates an environment where other countries, and in particular some intransigent actors like Australia, Scott Morrison, who really has made fairly feeble commitments thus far, this is going to put more pressure on them.
So finally, I mean, you raised something that I do want to ask you about, and that is because of our political process, because we elect a new president who could be of a different party every 4 years, every 8 years, how much could that be a setback to what the United States and the world are trying to do?
Yeah, well, you know, you live by the executive action, you die by the executive action, which is to say that anything that one administration does through executive actions, as you say, can be reversed. And that's what we saw with the Trump administration. So much of the progress that had been made under the Obama administration was reversed in just 4 years. And there's all that lost time, that opportunity cost of not having been acting in the meantime. And so, you know, what we need to do, as I said, we need to use those executive actions. And right now, the Biden administration is doing that, but it can only go so far. We need to codify those changes in terms of legislation. And with a divided Congress, with a divided Senate, with a tie-breaking vote by the Democratic vice president, and some Democrats who might not sign on to expansive climate legislation, clearly Joe Biden is going to need all of the diplomatic and tools at his disposal, and Democrats in Congress may have to use some of the parliamentary tools that they have at their disposal if we're to get climate legislation that will complement the executive actions that are being taken, and that's what we need.
Ambitious, but clearly also complicated. Michael Mann with Penn State University, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Judy.
As we've been mentioning, today is Earth Day. While carbon emissions and climate change are front and center, this is a good moment to look at another major environmental problem. As the world has become hyper-hygienic since the pandemic began, plastic is playing an oversized role. Stephanie Sy looks at how the single-use nature of many pandemic items are piling up in our landfills and in our environment.
They're the one item we now know helps stop the spread of COVID-19, face masks. They come in different shapes and sizes, and many are disposable.
Bonjour les enfants.
Over the past year, they've become an important part of living safely in the middle of a pandemic. Around the world, 129 billion are used every single month, and 3 million are thrown out every single minute. Most are made of layers of plastic microfibers. It's creating a new kind of plastic pollution, contaminating waterways and hurting wildlife. Maria Algara is the founder of Clean This Beach Up in Miami.
Let's see what we can collect in a couple of blocks in South Beach.
At the beginning of the pandemic, she found she had to expand her cleanup beyond the beach. She started the Glove Challenge, asking people around the world to tag places they found latex gloves littered. The results came flooding in. And before long, single-use face masks were strewn everywhere, too.
Every single cleanup that we do on a shoreline, we're collecting from 50 to 100 masks.
To see just how easy it is to spot pandemic pollution, we asked our NewsHour staff to keep their eyes open for it. From Washington, D.C. to California, they shared videos and photos of this new kind of litter.
Why is the mask pollution particularly concerning to you?
is not just about the fact that masks are not biodegradable or recyclable. It's about the fact that they are a hazard for our wildlife, not just because they can eat the mask, but also because animals get entangled in the straps.
Poor guy.
Algara and her team found a mask twisted around a puffer fish. Birds are getting caught up in them, and marine life are eating them.
So if I needed to dispose of this mask, Maria, do you have advice on how I could do that to minimize harm to animals and the environment?
The idea is to dispose of your mask properly, put it in the bin, but also remember to cut or rip off the straps. That will be saving so many lives.
Jenna Jambeck has made a career out of studying the waste we create.
We are the top waste generator by country and per person in the world.
The University of Georgia professor is currently driving and camping the length of the Mississippi River with her husband and two kids, all the while hunting for plastic debris. It's part of an initiative started by mayors of cities along the river to reduce plastic pollution by 20%. Jambeck brought her scientific expertise and, as a fellow at National Geographic, a network of educators. One way they're helping is with data. The Marine Debris Tracker is an app that lets people log exactly what they're finding and where. And like Maria Algara noticed on the ground in Miami, Jambeck said it didn't take long for reports of PPE in the environment to roll in.
Including masks, gloves, and wipes, we've seen over 11,500 items reported through just our app alone. I just think it's so reflective of sort of our actions and our activities and what we use on a daily basis. Some of that leaks out, and we sort of immediately pretty much saw that through this system.
And why and how are these things making their way into the environment?
So you go to the grocery store, you're using a disposable mask, you know, you go in and you need it, you know, the whole time you're shopping, and you come out and let's say you had a mask and gloves, and then you're like, well, these are dirty now, what do I do with them? And that sort of speaks to how we make and use things as well. We often don't think about end of life, meaning what do we do when we need to dispose of anything in the environment? It just really came to light, I think, through the PPE that we were wearing.
And it's not just medical protective gear that's adding to pandemic pollution. Many busy families balancing homeschool and work from home schedules in the last year relied on endless days and nights of takeout.
The leftovers shelf.
Much of it, including my family's, comes in plastic containers with single-use utensils.
I saw a lot of to-go packaging, to-go like clamshells, both foam and plastic, plastic bags, plastic bottles.
In some cases, places overcompensated on individual plastic packaging, believing it would prevent COVID from spreading. But many of these containers aren't recyclable. And in the U.S., we recycle less than 9% of the plastic we use. One company based outside Phoenix, Arizona, Footprint, is trying to disrupt the plastic packaging industry. CEO and co-founder Troy Swope showed us around.
To take waste to make something that only has a very short useful life, this is the best option for the planet.
The containers are made of plant-based fiber, including wood the company says is sourced from sustainable forests. Swope says they are compostable and biodegradable. Their biggest client is ConAgra, which uses Footprint containers for some of its brands. Takeout salad company Sweetgreen is a big client, and even McDonald's is testing out some of their lids.
To compete with plastic food packaging, Footprint tests its containers for durability. This simple experiment looks at whether the oil from the salad dressing bleeds through the product.
The key for why it doesn't, Swope says, is a proprietary coating they literally bake in, and they claim is free of harmful chemicals.
Number one, we focus on being plastic free. And the importance of that is at the end of life. We wanted something that had multiple end of life options. So the best way to put it is we wanted something nature could digest. So at the end of the day, if you just left it on the side of the road or got in an ocean, it would just disappear without being toxic to animals or to the water.
Do your products cost the same as the plastic alternative?
We design everything to be cost competitive with plastic. So from day one, we wanted to have a massive impact on the planet. So we at day one, we said we were going to have to develop the technologies to compete with plastic, not only in performance, but in price.
But it's not just where a product ends up that matters. It's how it begins. Energy and water go into manufacturing, even of biodegradable packaging like footprints that boast lower carbon emissions.
Alternative materials are definitely going to be part of the integrated approach, I think, to this. But we don't necessarily also just want to switch all of the single use over to that. We would, you know, I think we would like to reduce, you know, quantities first still if we can.
And ultimately, says Maria Algara, change will be driven by what each of us demands of government, corporations, and ourselves.
We could clean every single beach, every shoreline in the world, and that won't stop plastic pollution. The change starts with us and our choices and our consumption.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
While the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin brought celebration to the streets of Minneapolis, that same community came together today to mourn the death of another black man killed at the hands of police. John Yang reports on how the country is reacting. And a warning, some of the content of this report is graphic.
In Minneapolis, Minnesota today, the funeral of black 20-year-old Dante Wright, shot by a white Brooklyn Center police officer during a traffic stop.
Walking out! Walking out!
The funeral comes just days after a Minneapolis jury said former police officer Derek Chauvin was guilty of murdering George Floyd, a rare conviction of a police officer in the killing of a black person. But just minutes before, in Columbus, Ohio, a white police officer shot and killed 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant outside her foster home. The news unleashed a new wave of protests, grief, and anger over police killings, especially white officers killing black people. Hours later, Columbus police released body camera footage of the shooting. It appears to show Bryant holding a knife as she lunges toward another person a moment before she is shot.
Get down!
Ned Pettis, Columbus's public safety officer, said state officials were investigating.
Under any circumstances, that is a horrendous tragedy. But the video shows that there is more to this. It requires us to pause, take a close look at the sequence of events, and though it's not easy, wait for the facts as determined by an independent investigation.
A day later, a police officer shot and killed a 40-year-old black man in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Police have yet to release body cam footage.
It's just sad.
The shootings are a reminder of the unending pattern of killings of black Americans, often at the hands of police who, despite the Chauvin conviction, are rarely convicted of a crime. In the 2014 killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, at the hands of a white officer, no charges were ever filed. The incident sparked months of unrest. 2 years earlier, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black 17-year-old, was shot and killed in Sanford, Florida, by neighborhood watch captain George Zimmerman. The killing became a national flashpoint. Zimmerman was acquitted. Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, continues to speak out.
First of all, I want to say whoever said time heals all wounds did not lose a child. Because we are never going to heal. This country has done something to us that will never be repaired.
In Chicago, the shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo, who ran from police with a gun before holding up his empty hands, shook a community who just years before lived through another police shooting where law enforcement initially lied about what happened. White officer Jason Van Dyke became the city's first patrolman in almost 50 years to be convicted of murder. The verdict came 4 years after the shooting and only after police were ordered to release dash cam footage of Van Dyke shooting black 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times as he appeared to be walking away from police. To see how communities across the country are reacting to the Chauvin verdict, we are joined by public media reporters from communities that have also had to deal with the killing of unarmed Black men. Jason Rosenbaum is with St. Louis Public Radio. Brandis Friedman is with WTTW, the PBS station in Chicago. And Wilkin Brutus is a reporter for WLRN, South Florida's NPR member station. Welcome to you all. Thank you all for joining us. Brandis, in Chicago, of course, even as the trial was going on, Chicago was dealing with the Adam Toledo case there in itself. What's the reaction been there to what happened in Minneapolis?
I think all of this has kind of reinforced what a lot of activists have already been saying, even since last summer, and even long before the George Floyd death last summer. Obviously, you're aware that we had the Laquan McDonald case several years ago, a 17-year-old young man who was killed at the hands of a Chicago police officer, and he was convicted a couple of years ago. So a lot of folks are calling for a lot more accountability out of the Chicago Police Department and the mayor, and specifically, they want to see civilian oversight over the Chicago Police Department, which has been something they've been fighting for quite a while, and that I think will take quite some time before they reach something where both sides are kind of satisfied.
And Jason, in St. Louis, of course, the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, a flashpoint in this whole issue. What's been the reaction in St. Louis?
It's been a reaction of relief. And also, frankly, a lot of surprise. With the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, there was never any sort of trial either on a state or federal level. So to see a police officer be found guilty of a litany of charges for killing an unarmed Black man, I think a lot of activists here aren't used to that sort of thing. St. Louis and the St. Louis region have changed quite a bit since 2014, when Michael Brown was shot and killed by a Ferguson police officer, both politically and policy-wise. But I think that they feel like while this does bring a sense of closure to one incident, there's a whole lot of ways to go when it comes to overhauling police department and engendering trust between Black people here and police departments around the region.
Staying with you, Jason, of course, in St. Louis, or in Ferguson last year, in the midst of the protest over the George Floyd death, Ferguson elected its first Black mayor. St. Louis itself elected its first Black mayor. Has this changed people's attitudes? Is there hope now that there's going to be a greater connection between the communities and City Hall?
Certainly there is hope. One of the things that I think people around the country need to realize is, as I've already said, Michael Brown was shot and killed 7 years ago. And it took almost 7 years to see monumental political change, like Tashara Jones being elected the first Black woman mayor in St. Louis. And it's not only monumental because of that designation, but she ran on a number of platform planks that featured things that activists here have been calling for since Brown's death, which include shifting money from the police department to things like social workers and closing things like the workhouse, which is a notorious jail here in the city. So now is kind of the time for people that have been calling for change to put a lot of the calls of action into action, and they're hoping for people like Jones to actually follow through on them.
Wilkin, in Florida, of course, the Trayvon Martin case was one of the first to sort of focus attention on this issue. It wasn't police, but it was a community watch captain. What's changed since then in Florida, or has anything changed in Florida?
Yeah, Trayvon Martin's case was certainly a catalyst to bring attention to this sort of broad movement to address police and law enforcement accountability. There are certainly parallels that I can think of regarding the case surrounding Corey Jones, a man who was shot to death. And that was an accountability case where the police officer actually went to prison. And it showed this sort of multiracial solidarity. And that multiracial solidarity added pressure to local elected officials to pass legislation, or to at least attempt to pass legislation. And we're certainly seeing that in the city of West Palm Beach, where the mayor enacted a task force, a racial and ethnic equality task force, to address some of the disparities surrounding these underserved communities, which includes access to affordable housing, access to affordable health care. There's a myriad of socioeconomic issues that extends far beyond police brutality. And that Trayvon Martin case certainly amplified that, and certainly amplified hashtag say her name, that it isn't just Black men who are dying. There are also Black female victims involved in all of this. And so that's certainly something to consider when we're talking about Trayvon Martin and any other cases involving law enforcement accountability.
And Brandis, in Chicago, of course, since Laquan McDonald, there's a new mayor, there's a new state prosecutor, state's attorney. And yet we now find with the Adam Toledo case, many of the same issues back, many of the same frustrations back. Has anything really changed, or what has changed?
I think it depends on who you ask. You know, the mayor who is currently in office, she was the one who headed up the previous mayor, Rahm Emanuel's police accountability task force in the wake of the Laquan McDonald shooting. She ran as a reformer. And I think she's getting a lot of criticism now for not really presenting the reform that she promised would come. She just this week has said that, you know, she does stand by her superintendent of police who took the job just a little over a year ago. At what some might say is probably the worst time to take a new job like that. But some things have changed since the shooting of Laquan McDonald. Of course, there's the consent decree that the city and the police department have entered into with the federal government. And that is obviously a very long process. There's a lot of work to be done there. And as I mentioned, what a lot of activists here would really like is a lot more civilian oversight, where they're the ones who decides who the superintendent of police is and where they have control over the budget and things like that. So they've got a long way to go.
Jason, Brandis mentioned the consent decree of the Chicago police are operating under. The Ferguson police are also operating under a consent decree. Has that led to any changes either substantively in the department or maybe in public attitudes toward the department?
It absolutely has, but many people in the St. Louis region feel that the fact that the federal government only put a consent decree on Ferguson and not many other surrounding cities that are either largely Black or largely white with long records of police misconduct against Black people was a huge missed opportunity. And just changing Ferguson is not going to be the cure-all for the systemic racism that's been permeating around a huge region. And Ferguson has changed. As you mentioned, there's a Black mayor. Many of the key people within city government are African-American, and African-Americans have more representation on the city council. And because the consent decree was in place, they've had to make changes to their police department and city government because they've had no choice. But the fact that the rest of the region hasn't had that same force, I think many people feel was a huge missed opportunity on behalf of the Obama administration. And because we had a more conservative president that didn't really get into consent decrees or pattern or practice arrangements, there was really no opportunity to do anything else in the St. Louis region. Interestingly, the Justice Department has resumed that with the Minneapolis Police Department. And Republicans like Roy Blunt of Missouri have praised the Justice Department for doing that. And they're hoping that more things that are happening in Ferguson happen in other police departments around the country.
Wilkin Brutus in South Florida, Brandis Friedman in Chicago, Jason Rosenbaum in St. Louis. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can summer camp change the world? The documentary Crip Camp makes the case that one particular camp impacted the lives not only of the young people there, but the culture at large through the fight for disability rights. The film from the production company of Barack and Michelle Obama is vying for an Oscar this Sunday. Jeffrey Brown has our look for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
And then when I went to Jeanette, there I was in Woodstock.
Summer camp in upstate New York, 1971. Fun and frolicking, a Woodstock era vibe. But Camp Jeanette was an unusual camp for young people with a wide range of disabilities.
Come to Camp Jeanette and find yourself.
And that, says Jim Lebrecht, an attendee who'd been born with spina bifida, made all the difference.
Boy, I have to tell you, as a 15-year-old, it was like, like freedom. You didn't feel like you were a spectacle. You didn't feel like people were staring at you. You didn't feel like you were a burden.
Which was different from life back at home.
You know, you knew you were really different. There, I wasn't different.
Many years later, Lebrecht and Nicole Newnham have made Crip Camp, a documentary about Camp Jened and the larger disability rights movement. It features interviews with former campers and counselors.
And just feel like these people are crazy, you know, I mean, in a good way.
And archival footage shot in the 70s. It then follows camp participants who became trailblazers in a wider struggle.
It really all started with this theory that Jim had, which was that the camp was connected to this change that happened. And the idea was to try very hard to go back and find those seminal moments that connected through these characters that you meet as a band of friends in summer camp. And kind of filling that in, I think, enabled us to see something which otherwise we wouldn't be able to see, which is the impact of something very small and how it grows into something big.
Among the key protagonists, Judy Heumann, a camp counselor who contracted polio as a child. She would go on to become a leading disability rights activist.
They were announcing paraplegics stop traffic in Manhattan.
In this scene at a New York City protest.
There were only 50 of us, but basically, with the one street, we were able to shut the city down.
Judy just opened up my mind about the fact that, oh my gosh, we can actually fight back, like, this isn't fair. I mean, I know it's not fair that I have a hard time getting around in the real world, but that we actually have legal recourse.
And the structure that we thought of was like this camp experience of liberation was like a stone thrown in a pond, and you saw the ripples outward. And as the ripples of the impact of that liberatory experience grow, the movement grows and the community grows with it.
The film follows former campers who moved to California's Bay Area and built a flourishing community.
A small army of the handicapped have occupied this building for the past 11 days.
Several took part in a harrowing 1977 sit-in in San Francisco to demand federal regulations guaranteeing civil rights for the disabled.
That's when people started really feeling like we couldn't leave because no one knew what we were talking about, but we knew that they were trying to rescind the regulation.
So I figured, okay, we're going to have to spend the night.
The activism would culminate in the landmark 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, prohibiting discrimination based on disability and bringing changes to many aspects of American life. Many years later, though, that fight continues. Lebrecht himself, a veteran sound designer, has pushed for more representation of the disabled in television and movies, on and off camera.
What I believe is that the entertainment industry needs to really embrace us as part of their diversity and inclusion efforts and apply the same mentorships and opportunities for people within the community to establish and cultivate their careers. The fact of the matter is that because you may not see us working side by side on a set or in front of the camera doesn't mean we don't exist. We are there. We're underemployed.
Their own film, says Newnham, aims to open a window for a new audience.
The goal that Jim and I held dear throughout the entire filmmaking process was that we could shift people's view of disability from a medical model or a charity model to a rights-based model, and that people could see the exciting new perspective of coming to stories from a disabled point of view.
When we were there... There was no outside world.
Crip Camp vies for an Oscar for Best Documentary this Sunday. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
As we all hope, an end to the pandemic is in sight. This past year leaves a spotlight on a disease often overlooked, chronic fatigue syndrome. This week, more than 1,000 people living with chronic illnesses lobbied members of Congress for more support. Now, disability advocate Rivka Solomon offers her brief but spectacular take.
Leading up to this interview, I was definitely nervous and anxious, but I've done a lot of public speaking. However, What's tricky about doing these kinds of interviews is that you never know when your brain is just going to fly away and I will not be able to remember what it is I want to say. I won't be able to formulate sentences. When I was 21, two of my college roommates and I all got mononucleosis at the same time. They got better in a month or so, and I essentially never got better. After a year of being bedridden, I had a few years of semi-remission, but it didn't last. It all came back with a second infection, pneumonia, and I stayed sick for 3 decades. They called it chronic mono, then chronic Epstein-Barr virus, then chronic fatigue syndrome, and now they call it ME/CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome. Most of us just call it ME. There are up to 2.5 million of us in the US with ME, 24 million around the globe. We have no treatments, no cure, and people can be sick and disabled for decades, often bedridden like me, some unable to care for or feed themselves. 80% of people with ME got it after a viral or bacterial infection like me, and 75% of us are women. I might look vibrant and full of life right now, but what happens is that many of us with ME, all of us with ME, have post-exertional malaise. That's called PEM. And that means that after we do anything that requires any energy output, we will often collapse. We have a disproportionate payback. So after I do this interview with you, I might end up bedridden and unable to move, literally. When you have ME, it affects absolutely every single dimension of your life. Many of us, our families and friends, don't believe that we're actually sick. It is a terribly lonely existence. Right now, there are millions who are getting sick with COVID-19 from the coronavirus, and some are not getting better. They're staying sick with what's called long COVID. Many with long COVID will likely be eligible for an ME diagnosis after 6 months of being sick because they have many of the same symptoms as us. But something truly beautiful has come out of all this. The ME community and long COVID communities are helping each other. It is beautiful to see this. It's like the old timers helping the newbies, but the newbies have much more political clout and are also helping us. One of the problems that we've had as a community is that there's been a faction of the medical establishment that has put forth and propagated the myth that this isn't a real disease, that it's actually a psychological condition. So for example, in the 1980s, Newsweek had a headline on their front, they had a cover on, sorry. As you can see, my brain is beginning to go, right? You can see that happening here. Even right now, as I'm doing this interview with you, I can feel the brain fog is taking over. And I can't remember what your question was, and I can't remember what the beginning of my sentence was. I don't remember the point that I'm trying to make. The one thing I want people at home to take away is to believe a person when they tell you how they're feeling. Don't dismiss them. Don't disregard them. Believe them and have compassion. My name is Rivka Solomon, and this is my brief but spectacular take on advocating for people with chronic illness.
And Rivka Solomon, we thank you for sharing your story and the story of so many others. And you can find all of our brief but spectacular segments online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe. And we'll see you soon.